this is the first in a series of interviews for LQ Radio. As this was the first in the series, there were a few technical difficulties. We had a small problem with Skype that lasted till about a minute and a half to 2 minutes into the recording. We did correct the problem and are working to make sure it doesn't happen again in future interviews. Thanks for the patience. And now...
LinuxQuestions.org presents LQ Radio, the number one online radio broadcast focusing on Linux and open source. And now, LQ Radio, open talk about open source.
Hello, and welcome to the very first LQ Radio interview. Today, I have Tom Adelstein and Sam Heiser with me. First, let me say thank you both for agreeing to be the first two guests in the interview series. As you can tell, we are probably going to run into a few problems, but I will make the best of it. Can you both hear me now?
I can hear you, Ned.
Okay. I figured I might as well complicate things as much as possible for the first show and have two of you, so let's see how it goes. First, let me read a little bit from each of your bios, and then I'll have you introduce yourself and add anything you'd like. Sam Heiser is a new Linux consultant and migration specialist based in New York City. He was a volunteer marketing project lead and consultant to Sun Microsystems for the OpenOffice.org development project through its 20 millionth download. Along with Adelstein, Heiser founded JDSHelp.org, a community site providing support and resources to users of the Java desktop system around the world. He is a contributing editor of Linux World magazine and writes on open source and information technology for The Economist and other publications. Tom Adelstein works as a Linux consultant and specializes in identifying opportunities for open source software in organizations. He also works with the Open Source Software Institute. He recently published two articles in Forbes about open source software and JBoss. He has also written numerous articles as a guest editor for a variety of publications and is a regular web columnist for Linux Journal. So welcome, guys. Do either of you have anything to add to those?
No, I think that's fine.
Tom, you want to go ahead?
I'm fine, and I think it's fine.
Did you have anything you wanted to add, Sam?
Oh, no. That we're doing, we have our open source, professional open source business sites are going now. We're dedicating that to support, train, and consulting to help organizations figure out our software.
Do you have a URL for that?
Heiser, H-I-S-E-R, hyphen, A-D-E-E-I-N.com.
Okay. And that's a fairly new joint venture?
Yes, it's a global associate. Professional, so we have people from all over the planet, even outside the U.S. Will be capable.
Great.
Of training services.
Fantastic. You guys jointly founded JDSHelp.org and have worked closely with Sun in the past, but a recent Linux World, I know that you were also recommending Novell to people. In this case, the person I have in mind is Doc Sarles. What are your current thoughts on Sun and JDS?
Well, this is Tom. We were actually not recommending Novell to Doc. We attempted to get his... He had an assignment to put Linux on a laptop and then write a series, an article, or a series on it. And as you know, Jonathan Schwartz had said that they had just done an internal rollout. So when we took him over to the Sun booth, they said, no, we haven't done an internal rollout, and no, we don't have the technology, and no, we can't put it on this laptop. Huh. So Novell had volunteered to do it, and that was a second option, but that was, you know, a better option than than nothing. So we just went over to the Novell booth with him.
Okay.
But our relationship with Sun is, I would say, deteriorated totally.
And in your opinion, what has that been a result of?
What? Could you repeat that?
In your opinion, what has that deterioration been a result of?
Well, just things that we've found out about Sun, that they represented certain things existed that didn't exist. We just don't see Sun as really leaning in the favor of Linux. The people that we talk to who are in that organization have gone through a number of changes, and they're essentially saying that other companies are using Linux against them, so that they view Linux as very antagonistically. That's a problem, and we're not in it to make Sun Solaris open source. I mean, I don't think the product's even close to being ready for prime time, and then when it is, I don't know how it'll ever stay up with Linux.
I still have my questions on that note of how much they really can open source Solaris. I know a lot of the code just isn't theirs to open source.
Well,
they tried.
Go ahead, Tom.
Okay. Well, they tried to buy as much of it as they could, and there are big pieces missing which need to be developed, obviously. And that's why they went to the open source community. So they're trying to recruit people to come in. But one of the other things you have to realize is that they had a ready-made open source community because they just took all of their 1,000 developers on Solaris and put them over on the other side of the firewall. So that's their community.
Okay.
Is the former. So they have to rewrite a lot of stuff.
Okay. And you were going to add something, Sam?
Well, just that our relationship with Sun is not good right now, despite all the things we did with JDSHelp.org, and as much faith as we had in Sun's ability to deliver a decent Linux desktop. But what we came to realize was that I think customers have huge questions about, this is enterprise customers, have questions about Sun's ability to be a Linux, to support a Linux product or suite or stack faithfully because of their corporate financial situation and the imperatives for them to support and push Solaris heavily. So there are internal conflicts there that cause the individuals and the groups at the company to behave in a very schizophrenic manner, and particularly the Linux people cannot feel but undermined by the messages that come out against Linux. And so how can the Linux product teams and any corporation do their job effectively or with any confidence when their senior management have things coming out every week that are in direct opposition and, in fact, are defamatory to the Linux community or to other organizations who are strong in Linux?
So do you think long-term JDS Linux is something that they'll continue to release and support, or do you see it going away at some point?
Well, you're looking at JDS, what it is, it's a rebranding of SUSE SLES 9, and customers have to ask themselves, why would I go to a Chevy dealer to buy a Volvo, or which is a Ford product, when I can go to a Ford dealer and buy a Volvo, and my life is so much simpler that way. So customers, enterprise customers, might wonder why Sun bothers to have a Linux desktop product. I think there are several initial motivations that they had going back a few years now, and a lot of it had to do with getting a Java onto the desktop to compete against .NET, against Microsoft, and there are other factors there too. Tom may be able to add a few things, but I think enterprise customers, if they are J2EE shops, they could put Linux, you know, they could roll out Linux desktops and make sure that Java, a decent Java runtime, got attached to that themselves. And they are doing that. So you don't need Sun to rebrand somebody else's Linux desktop, just to desktop. And I think that's one of the reasons enterprises, governments, educational institutions are not really going for JDS very much right now.
Well, they've also reorganized four times. So when you reorganize four times, you're going to run into some problems, especially when you have to change bosses. And they've had four heads of what you would call the JDS group, and each one of them has a different vision for the product. The most recent vision is to use it on the Sunray, which is their thin client.
Okay.
So they're trying to bundle it for that, but they're not really going after the customer base that Linux typically goes after.
Okay.
They're trying to bundle it with their hardware and then sell the whole solution as a change in the infrastructure of an enterprise.
So they kind of moved away from the offering the Linux desktop and then going after the service market, and they're kind of shifting that.
No, they're not even after the service market. They don't. They literally, if you look at all the things they do that's open source, they have a community set up, and it's usually on collab.net, and they pay collab.net a lot of money to set those communities up, but there's no community set up for JDS Linux. And we set that up. We set it up in July of last year because they literally had no people in that group. That they didn't have a boss. They didn't have a director. Everything had fallen apart. They weren't selling it. They weren't supporting it. People were complaining. And we were on the forums, and so that's when we started. We organized a group of people who agreed to be on the forums. We set up a site. We started delivering patches. They didn't even have patches for the kernel and for problems that they were having. So we stepped in and basically took over the services as a volunteer organization. And they thought that was great because all of a sudden here was this organic community that just formed out of nowhere. Well, it formed out of necessity. It formed out of the fact that people needed support, and there were enough older, mature Linux people in the group to offer that kind of service, just, you know, voluntarily. And then once we got organized, they tried to work with us, but they just didn't understand how to work with a community, and made a lot of promises they never kept, avoided phone calls, avoided emails, just it's like there was no communication.
And so do you think JDSHelp.org is something that you'll continue to run, or is it just not worth the effort at this point?
Well, we're establishing something called linhelp.org, and that will include, if JDS doesn't EOL, right, if Sun doesn't end of life JDS as the desktop option, there's no reason we should include a tab or a whole environment just to do these things for a Java desktop system that we would do for other distros, such as the Devel Linux, such as Ubuntu, Tom, Fedora, Core 3, perhaps.
Okay.
Any Linux distros that we feel are strong contenders. And of course, the activities that we undertook with this group for JDS Help was really an extension of our real strong confidence that Sun had come up with a good Linux desktop. The first two versions of JDS, which had started to come out from the Mad Hatter project back at the end of 2003, were excellent Linux distros, and projected a real commitment on the part of Sun. And we responded to that by writing the book. And they were back at that time. This is December 2003. They might have been six months ahead of other Linux distros in terms of the quality, the rendering, and the completeness and the decisions that they made to include and exclude certain applications. And the whole thing was very professionally done. And they went, within the space of a year, they went from 6 months ahead to more than a year behind, based on what we experienced with the JDS Release 3 beta, which took place last Christmas and in January. So we've been fairly disillusioned and seen firsthand what a lot of restructuring can do to a company and to the individuals and their morale. And
yeah, four changes is definitely going to be tough to keep up with for any group. So based on your recommendation...
That was the whole...
Go ahead.
Well, that was the problem. Curtis Sasaki was the head of the group. He was the visionary that started it, and now he's no longer there. And after he left, then they started the new effort for the most recent release, and it's just not the same quality. Just the person that engineered it originally is not there anymore. And so you've got a new person there who's head of engineering, and his background is not engineering. It's finance. So he's making decisions from a different paradigm.
Sure. And based on your recommendation of Novell to Doc, or I guess not recommendation, but the second choice that you had to go with, what are your thoughts on Novell and the Novell desktop, and I guess also SUSE Professional? What are your thoughts on those two?
Are you excluding Red Hat?
I'll just go first. What's that, Tom?
Oh, I just want to know, are you excluding Red Hat?
Well, right now I'm excluding Red Hat and just asking about Novell, but I'll address
that. Just about Novell, okay.
I'll start, Tom. You can follow up. I just say that I've been using NLD, the Novell Desktop 9 Eval product that they've had out since the fall. I've been using it on my laptop, and I'm very pleased with it. It's a great desktop, and it's very encouraging if that reflects, you know, the way Linux keeps improving, especially the enterprise versions. Tom has done some a great series of articles on Linux Journal, Jeremy. You may have been paying attention to where he's gone through and reviewed all the different desktops.
Yep.
Novell is one of them, and it's one of them that we feel very positively about. Tom,
I like it. I'm not, if you ask me, if I was an enterprise customer, would that be the product that I would recommend to an enterprise? Probably not.
So moving into my next question then, what other distributions, going from RHEL to Fedora to Ubuntu, what other ones in the enterprise space do you like, and what ones do you dislike?
Well, I like Red Hat's desktop. Now, this is not the WS, which was a workstation, and this is a new product that's been developed primarily by Havoc Pennington and a group in Boston. It's a pretty big group for Red Hat. And I personally believe that's the best desktop I've seen so far. I've taken Fedora Core 3 and done some re-engineering on it. It's very stable now. It's something that I would say someone could use. There's a lot of updates there. I think there's like about 400 packages that I updated after I installed it again recently. Mm-hmm. And I've re-engineered it, done some things. It allows you to tweak it and optimize it with normal Linux things. And it's really, to me, that's the best one. And it's reflective of Red Hat's desktop, which is the rest, I guess this could be desktop 4.
Right.
That's the one I like the best.
I use Fedora.
Ubuntu is probably going to be up there sometime around the first quarter of 2006. There's a lot of broken things in it.
So, and you'd think it'll take them that long to kind
of get things together? Well, that's actually their own roadmap.
Okay.
Did you see?
I mean, they're out there, basically testing it. A lot of people love it, but and they're giving professional support behind it, but it's not working 100%. Everything's not working. They're fixing and patching and doing things.
Right. Well, I was gonna say, on my home desktop for probably about a year now. And I'm at Core 3 right now, and I think it's great for kind of the Linux enthusiast, but at an enterprise level, between the 6 to 8 month life cycle and kind of the amount of polish on it, it's probably not something I'd want to roll out in that capacity.
Can I address that point particularly, Jeremy?
Sure.
You say you don't recommend certain desktop distros for the enterprise or the casual user or but you do recommend it for the heavy hardcore, you know, hands-on Linux person. I think that this question is such an important question that you ask, which is, you know, which desktops do you like and which don't you, and you know, which do you recommend? And so we deal with organizational clients, and we're analysts, and we recommend software to end user organizations. And I think that one of the technologies, if you will, that we provide is experience with all of the software and all of the businesses and companies behind the software and all of the tools that each company delivers. And one of the things that, for example, puts Red Hat out in front of everybody is they have terrific configuration and deployment tools. And Red Hat Network is unparalleled in its ability to run updates and to deliver, deploy new systems out onto a whole bunch of old Windows machines, just for example.
And manage them.
Yeah, no one has an answer to like RHN plus Kickstart, where you can roll out one image remotely over the network.
Well, when you ask the question,
now say that again.
Jeremy?
Yep.
So can you just say that again? No one has a solution to what?
I haven't seen another Linux company at this point that has a product that can compete on the same level as if you deploy using Kickstart plus RHN, you can basically say, I have three groups of servers, you know, maybe one's web server, one's Oracle servers, and one's other. And based on that, you can install 1,000 machines and have them come up configured correctly. The web servers as web servers, the Oracle machines as Oracle machines. And I've not seen another company that's come out with a product that can do that as well as quickly.
And the desktop too now. Because if when you add proxy and you add satellite, or satellite, depending on how big your rollout is, no one can do it like Red Hat. Red Hat is the only company that does it right.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I think you're going to see Novella uses a ZenWorks product, which I haven't seen firsthand, but I know that's going to be trying to accomplish some of those same things. So you're going to see competition and good capabilities in these areas. But what I was addressing was this demand among user organizations to try to, you know, to get help to decide among these desktops. And what one of the things we're trying to accomplish at Heiser Adelstein is to create a framework of thinking about how do I go about deciding about a Linux desktop for my organization. And what you have, Jeremy, is the spectrum from very good, full-blown enterprise distributions with all the tools and config and management and rollout services like Red Hat, back down to the raw distro like a Debian.
Sure.
Or pure Fedora Core, all of which might be useful in an enterprise, but each choice along that spectrum would require more hands-on involvement by the deploying organization, such as you might, if you go to the raw solution, you might have to have a little cadre of Linux people who are almost like rolling your own distro based on Debian or on Ubuntu, for example. And many companies, particularly the larger ones, are likely to choose the Red Hat solution, and because it's almost a turnkey, they can just say, "Look, I'm not in the IT business. I don't want to be. You know, Red Hat, you do this, or Novell, you do this." So you have all this choice, and it's a bit of a confounding situation because everyone wonders, you know, now there's this industry in the media of, you know, which distro, and I think enterprises, mature organizations, are less tolerant or more easily bored by this conversation that we have in the community of which distro.
Well,
we need to make it easier for people to choose.
One very good point, and that's why I hate the question, what is the best distro? Because it should be obvious that there isn't a best distro, just like there's not a best car or, you know, a best almost anything. It's really, you need to look at the situation. What are you trying to do? You know, what's the skill level of the organization? Are you rolling it out to engineers, or are you rolling it out to marketing people?
It really takes an organization being in touch with what its culture is. You know, the end user company that wants to deploy the thing.
Absolutely.
Ought to be more in touch with its IT culture and what its requirements are.
And what's your guys' opinion on distros such as, say, Zandros and Linspire that kind of almost even hide the fact that they're Linux and kind of cater to
that's what I was going to say. That's what I was going to address.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, well, first of all, I think for just the average user, what you say is a person who's not skilled at Linux, and I think that's what you were talking about when I mentioned Core 3. Linspire's a perfect product for someone who doesn't have much computer knowledge other than using it, and it's really a nice product. I worry about Zandros because of their financial situation.
So in the case that someone's looking for that very, very basic non-Linux user distro, your choice right now would be Linspire?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And there's a lot of reasons for that. It's fun. It competes really nicely with anything Microsoft's got. They've got, they've licensed the Windows Media Player. You've got capabilities of running all kinds of multimedia products, and it's a strong, I would say, consumer type product. I don't think they're even close to being what we would consider an enterprise product. It would be the difference between Microsoft XP Home and Microsoft Professional. You just wouldn't put Home in a company, I don't think.
Okay. And I've never used Linspire. Does it come with MP3 support out of the box or no?
Yeah.
It does. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's one of the few then that do.
Yeah, what he's done is he's gone and he's licensed everything.
Okay.
He's put a lot of money into it, and the 5.0 is really nice. And I think if you're going to say I want to try Linux, and you're not too adventurous, I mean, of course you'd have to be a little adventurous to try Linux, but that's the one you go with.
Less and less, so I would say you have to be less and less adventurous. That is.
Well, that's an interesting subject. Where are we in the adoption process of this new innovative desktop or operating system technology? And so far, we're early on the curve.
Yeah, I think so.
We're getting toward critical mass, but we're not there yet. Now, when I was speaking about Fedora Core 3, I was talking about people like you and me.
Okay.
People like you and me who use Linux, understand Linux, and could use any kind of a machine that we want to. I think that's really right now the most stable and best product for just the guy who wants to have a desktop that's a Linux guy who understands how to run a few commands and likes the different applications.
Yeah, I've tended to like it. I mean, I use that and I use one Slackware box. Although I don't have problems with either of them, I have to say. Do you guys use Slackware at all anymore, or no?
I haven't in a while. I don't know why, just other than there was a period of time where they went from... I think they had a period where you could just download it really quickly, and then they were supported by some organization like CD-ROM or whatever. I can't remember. And then they had to go...
Walnut Creek
website and all that. And when they did that, I just got out of touch with them.
Ah, okay.
But I had used Slackware. That was my first real distribution.
Yes, it seems like a lot of people's first distribution was Slackware.
Yeah.
At least of the old time users.
Well, when you go to 95, there were only 30,000 Linux users in the world. So
yeah.
Get a little bit later and you get Slackware. That's really the first one that was a distro.
Yeah, actually, I started on Yggdrasil because it came with that big book. And I was in a bookstore one day, and that's how I picked it up.
Mm-hmm.
So moving away from the distro topic a little bit, as two well-connected Linux consultants, you guys get a fairly good high-level look at what some of the larger Linux companies are doing. What current trends are you seeing from those companies in the Linux market?
Now, you're talking about the vendors?
Correct.
People that sell Linux services, sell Linux itself?
Correct.
Sam?
Well, we've really touched on a lot of that. I think if you look at the important Linux vendors, if you think of the deliberately enterprise distros, it's Red Hat, Novell, and what would be Sun and JDS, but it's hard to recommend JDS now until they get their act together on Linux, if they ever can. But you just see this natural progression of the product suite maturing, the desktop itself, the software has all the missing pieces, all those objections that the migrators used to raise. Say, I can't go to Linux now. It doesn't do X or doesn't do Y, and I need X and Y, and I need Z too. Well, now X, Y, Z, and A, B, and C, and D, and E are there, but also these tools that we talked about are really important for these large organizations that are basically Windows shops, and they need, you know, to talk about a Linux desktop in a large organization, that desktop has to be 3 or 4 or 5 times better than what it's replacing just to get the look in. And so these large vendors are, I think, particularly Red Hat and Novell, are doing a pretty good job moving this thing forward a lot faster than we expected it to be moving.
There's also a pretty good embedded Linux market, and those players are doing very well. And then you've got what I call second tier, not third party, but second tier players, and people like Computer Associates, IBM, Oracle, Dell, people like that, HP, and they're all doing quite well with it. The trends are toward consolidation, changeovers, you know, to an alternative desktop for security, et cetera. And what I see as far as what's going on in the 2.6 kernel, I think reflects more the vendors' wishes to make Linux even better than it is. When you take a look at Oracle, I mean, they're basically replacing lots and lots and lots of Solaris boxes and the old HP UX and other just Unix operating systems with Red Hat. And I think Dell is doing very, very, very well. So from a vendor point of view, they're doing excellent. And they're getting further and further along in their comfort level with Linux, even though they've always been considered a Microsoft shop. They still are a Microsoft shop.
They're often considered the hardware arm of Microsoft.
Well, they're not really anymore.
They recently started offering a workstation preloaded with Linux again.
I'm glad you mentioned Dell in there, Tom, because I was just talking to them at a Wall Street conference last week, and they reiterated that while you can perceive them as the hardware arm of Microsoft, they're asserting their independence now. And believe it or not, it's Michael Dell who has his hair on fire about Linux.
Well, I think what we really need is a major manufacturer preloading Linux on not only workstations like Dell is now, but consumer machines. Do you think that's something that we'll see soon?
I think you're right, Jeremy.
Sam, let me handle this one, because this is one that I've been working on. I can't tell you who and what, even though if it ever came to litigation, I could. But you can take a look at Dell, and you can see that they're kind of like Apple in a lot of ways. They've got a lot of peripheral products that you can purchase. They have their own printers, their own PDAs, wireless cards, and a variety of things that you can purchase from them. They're the likely candidate to offer all the drivers and everything, so that you can go in, and if you want to buy a desktop or laptop, and you want a printer, and you want a scanner, and you want a digital camera, and you want all those things, and you want it with Linux, that's the place you're going to get it.
So you would think Dell would be the first one?
Yes.
I can hear you agreeing in the background.
Well, it's going
to
be
so they're closer than anyone right now.
Yeah, it's
going to be HP's not close.
To do that,
I don't think HP's close.
Especially for the consumer. I wanted to circle back on something, Tom, you said before when you were focusing on the enterprise side with Oracle, and that is that we spend a lot of time as individuals in the open source community talking about the desktop, because that's our personal experience, our personal individual experience, and within that conversation, which is the large part of what you see on blogs and on online media, news forums, you know, that excludes this very important conversation of Linux and the needs of larger organizations. And I think it's really critical that your Dells, that your Oracles, that your CAs, certainly that IBM, are very big believers in this innovative operating system and all of the, you know, possible derivatives and extensions that flow from it. And Dell's such an interesting topic because now we circle back to this is a large vendor that also has a really great retail model. And, you know, IBM, for example, copies the Dell catalog in its small business. IBM small business catalog looks a lot like the Dell catalog. It's patterned on the Dell catalog, which is just terrific because, and that's what's going to send your Dell well past its $80 billion revenue goal. And, in fact, I think they recently just raised that. And it's just going to mean that Dell is going to, you know, carve up a bigger and bigger share of that hardware market at a time when, you know, hardware is a hard business to justify being in.
There's also another thing, Sam, and that is outside the United States, that nobody talks about Microsoft. They just talk about Linux. And anybody that wants big global share, and Dell has never really been that big a player in the international market, as a lot of people think. But once they start to play in the international market with their consumer items, they're the likely winner and inheritor of the global market spot.
Well, that actually
especially
brings up one of
they're providing all those drivers.
That's one of the actually one of the next things I was going to bring up was Linux sales look to be really strong moving forward in emerging areas such as China and Asia in general, really. Do you think that's a trend that will continue? And who do you think, both on the hardware and the distribution or software side, who's best poised to take advantage of that?
I think this is an interesting question because I have a question about IBM selling their PC business to a Chinese company and wondering if that's not a move Microsoft is interested in making with them so that they can get back in that market. Now, that's one of the things about IBM products with the IBM label is it always says we recommend Windows XP so you can get those marketing dollars. Depending on how that goes, there should be no barriers whatsoever to complete adoption of Linux in China, Japan, Malaysia, Singapore, the major markets. That's not just continuing, that's escalating. And it's also escalating in New Zealand and also Australia. You're also seeing a tremendous amount of movement in developing countries with Linux. Europe is strong with Linux. I mean, the Middle East is very strong with Linux. So those markets are all not only emerging, but they're escalating. We're not seeing that same escalation. We're lagging behind that in the U.S. But that's where your vendors have to play now. HP has been trying to take advantage of the Linux movement in emerging countries in the Pacific Rim. But I think Dell has the best chance at it if they go ahead and offer a Linux product that goes with their other consumer products.
Okay. Anything to add, Sam?
I can add to that. That covers it real well, but I think you're not going to see a U.S. company being the major vendor in those markets, even though Dell will do well, IBM will do well through Lenovo, which is the Chinese company that's acquiring their PC business. One of the great things about open source software and Linux in particular is it gives the local economy, the local government, a good basis to promote local industry. So you're going to see these vendors and the service companies that are that form around Linux and open source software. They're going to be domestically rooted, and that's already taking place in Costa Rica and Brazil. Despite that, there being some strength from the usual five U.S. Hardware and software vendors in those markets. So it's a good thing for local economies.
And Tom, you had mentioned Europe too. Munich has selected a distro for the Linux migration, and they're moving ahead with it. And while it was SUSE along with IBM that did the original year-long pilot, the city chose to go with Debian for the final rollout. And of course, one has to wonder if SUSE was still an independent German company, if they would have been selected as opposed to its now US-based Novell. What are your thoughts on the fact that they selected a non-commercial, quote-unquote, distro? And do you think that's a direction that other government or even large enterprise customers will follow?
Yeah, I do. There's a tremendous amount of dissatisfaction with the commercial companies in government. That's just the problem. And they feel like if they're going to have to do their own support, why should they be paying for it? And I found that I've spoken to people at the Department of Energy labs that have the same feelings. So I think that was a financial decision, and the fact that they have to do their own support.
Sam, you were saying?
Yeah, Tom and I were talking about this. Once an organization gets its minds and experience around the Linux desktop, if they go through the pilot, they roll something out, or they bang on it real hard for the test period, and their people get more familiar with Linux, they're much more capable of rolling their own. And so you might see a natural progression where organization starts with a full-blown Red Hat distro, and they get more confident, they understand what it is, and the individuals get more confident with Linux administration. They could easily identify something in a Debian, like apt-get, for example, as a critical piece of functionality that would really argue for that distro. And so you can see them moving down that spectrum to a more raw distro. Plus, as Tom said, the considerations are budgetary, so they can maybe see the cost advantage of having their own little internal, certainly governments are this way, their internal Linux shop that takes care of the desktops and the servers for the whole organization.
So you don't see that?
I don't think there was a problem with it being SUSE in Germany.
Okay, that's actually the question I was going to ask. You don't see the fact that SUSE was sold to a U.S. company is playing much of a role in this then?
No, because a lot of Linux development goes on in Germany for almost everybody. I mean, all the Linux distributors are using German engineers because they're more familiar with it than anyone.
Sure. All right, I'm gonna.
They're just tremendous, man. I mean, the Open Office is built almost entirely in Germany. Star Office. You take a look at those teams. They're very large teams, and SUSE. They didn't move those guys over to the United States, in case you didn't know.
Oh, sure.
So they're still there, but SUSE was not as entrenched in the European market as a lot of people believed. Red Hat actually sells more in Europe than SUSE does.
I think Mandrake still does well over there.
Especially in France.
Not that well.
I don't know how far the adoption has gotten outside of France.
Yeah, it's not very big at all. Red Hat is the favorite of the big companies. SUSE more the smaller companies. But when I was doing a lot of work as a partner with IBM, that was one of the surprising things, is that the big banks and all didn't want SUSE. They wanted Red Hat.
It's interesting. All right, I'm going to completely switch topics now. And I recently blogged about a ZDNet article about the importance of open document formats. Tom, I know you do a lot with Linux in governments, where I think open document formats are extremely important. And Sam, you were quite a bit with the OpenOffice.org group. So I would assume that you both have some comments on this one.
Sam, go first.
What was the question?
what are your thoughts on the importance of open document formats?
Oh, well, that's, I live and breathe and you know, breathe the air of this theme, because it's, you know, it's the file format of the Office suite is one of the, you know, crucial junctures where open standards really are going to make an impact. And they actually have a real strong influence on the way we operate our lives daily on our desktops. And governments are especially sensitive to the issue, because it potentially gives the citizens open, free access to public information. And so that's actually one of the drivers that's helping the adoption of Open Office and its wonderful new open document file format in adoption around the world. So, yeah, I mean, yes. It's all good, and we're headed in the right direction.
And do you think OpenOffice.org is something that we'll see adoption of, especially in the U.S. government, soon on any level, or is it still way far off?
Tom?
Well, I think it's far off. I think the portable document format is more used now. And I don't like it personally, but that's what's in use the most.
But that doesn't let you really get at the data in the sense that you can edit it, and you're still
someone
beholden to Adobe.
That's one of the big problems. One of the things that has been around for a while is DocBook, if you're familiar with that.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people that use DocBook. The problem is there's no tools. So it's almost entirely things that are edited manually, like the way we used to use a general markup language. It's XML-based, but a lot of these documents are that way now. When the Internet first came around and I started getting documents off, they were always in the PS format, as you remember. Then it started going to the PDF, and PDF seems to be the one that's been surviving in government today, and DOC, the DOC format. The problem with Word is that you have a problem with the 2003 formats, and then what Microsoft wants to do with the .NET stuff. So if they don't go into the open format, the Oasis style open format, I think they're gonna wind up like WordPerfect used to be, where they used to have a big presence, but now you can hardly find any WordPerfect documents anywhere.
And what do you think, as far as OpenOffice.org adoption in government right now, what's the biggest obstacle to that?
It's mostly just entrenched procurement practices. It's when someone goes to make a decision on, you know, on government procurement, it's just what's in the catalog, and you don't see OpenOffice.org in the catalog.
So that means, do you think it would possibly be Star Office?
Commercial off-the-shelf software.
So Star Office, you think, might have a better chance?
No, I don't think so. I'm not seeing Star Office pushed by Sun. Sun doesn't seem to be really moving a lot of their marketing muscle behind that. They've kind of just not done much with their software. They've made it available to every academic institution in the world for free, and yet people just aren't, they're just not sending people out and saying, hey, do you know this is available? So you're not seeing that. You're not seeing Sun, as far as the government's concerned, used to be the vendor, and now they're being pushed aside quite a bit. So now I don't see Star Office as that. Now, Open Office may gain a big foothold, but it's going to be someone like Linspire, who's come out with a product that you can buy in the store, and it's commercial off-the-shelf software. So you can go in, you see that they have this this box that you can buy in any store like CompUSA or Office Depot or any
place like that, and it's got OpenOffice on it plus Firefox, and that's the kind of marketing they're doing. And so they've commercialized it and vendorized it and made it off the shelf. When that starts to penetrate, and of course they're now is that the you know they look for commercial office software, and the only person right now that's marketing OpenOffice and Firefox, you know, to in the retail space or in the place where you can buy that stuff is Linspire.
Okay, switch topics again. Do either of you have any comments on the recent BitKeeper issue? And did any of you think that it would get as heated as it has gotten over the last week or so?
I think it's going to be more heated?
Did you think it would get as heated as it did, and do you think that will continue, or do you think we've kind of hit the peak and it's going to settle down?
I don't know if it'll continue, but I did expect it to get eventually become a problem because of the proprietary nature of it. And, you know, it's kind of like free software people are just have a different view of the world. And though it was a good product for Linus, I mean, Linus has surrounded himself with free software people who are really committed to this paradigm, and the uptake on it in this level of adoption is they're purist, and you know that was a problem, and it created a conflict. I think any time that you start to mix the two product lines or the two types of products, you're going to run into problems. My personal opinion, it's like the BitKeeper thing is the same thing in corporations. I think that there's a place for Microsoft. I think it's maybe 10% of the users can use the features that are there, but the rest of the people will never use those features. So they need to. So companies are oversold. But there's always a real place for some proprietary software. I think there could be for Linux, but you know Linus, and I don't think Linus did anything wrong. I just think it created a problem because there's other people that are just so pure in this model. I think I was expecting to get heated, and it could get heated again.
Your thoughts, Sam?
It may very well get heated.
I don't think it'll. Sorry? Jeremy, you there?
Yep.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I don't think it'll get any more heated because I think there's a couple solutions even better than the ones the one Linus is now trying to code for himself called Git.
What do you think those solutions are?
Well, there's one that's got a pretty good concept called CodeVille done by... the Cohen brothers, you know Bram Cohen, who did BitTorrent?
Mm-hmm.
His brother Ross, who was a network guy for Akamai for a while, they put their heads together. And Bram has actually been working on a replacement to CBS for a while, thinking about it pretty hard. And his idea was, when we're saving code, taking snapshots of code in a repository, let's just save the diffs and not snap the whole thing. And I think what the direction Linus is going on his own project is a pretty inefficient approach to the problems and doesn't really advance the solution. Now, Linus has the power to formulate a tool that's useful to him for his particular the problems for his particular project. And I think there's a healthy set of solutions coming out of the BitKeeper problem.
Right, I was going to say, I think what he's doing now at Git is just throwing something together that will allow him to work.
Yeah,
I don't think
just
that
wants something to work. So he may be successful for Linux. Project.
Just for himself, yeah. I don't think he's even trying to get
solution.
Something that's generally useful out of it.
Yeah, that's not his objective. So it does sponsor a healthy discourse on what's the ideal CVS system and what are the kinds of objectives a general system ought to have. And I think there's some of those goals are already pretty well formed already. But the the issue, it will get heated from time to time. It did get heated. It's a passionate issue for developers, but it's an important one, and also important because it reflects the problems that projects like OpenOffice are facing with the proprietary dependencies on Java that are increasing in the OpenOffice 2 version that's in beta right now. And that's a contentious issue. It's a big challenge for open source projects to limit the number of proprietary dependencies that end up in their code bases because they come back to haunt you, just like BitKeeper did.
Sure.
Project.
And it seems like the media is really overplaying between – they're trying to make it like it's a battle between Linus and Tridge and then Bruce and Linus. And it seems to me, at least, like the media is kind of overplaying the whole thing just to make a story.
Well, it's made for the media because
absolutely.
There's personality involved, and I think they feed on it. So you know, we just have to put it in perspective.
Do you think the media has a potential to damage the community here by over-exaggerating it, or do you think this one will just kind of heal up pretty quick?
It's like the campaign that we have for president. I mean, every week there was a new issue, but then it would die down. I think it's the same kind of thing. It's just media stuff. They're trying to drum up hits and sales and interest. It's just anytime they have something that they can land on with all their hands and feet and all that they'll do it, and you know, they just blow everything out of proportion. So yeah, it's a product of media itself. It's like Bruce may have said something, but I don't think like it should have been broadcasts all over the world.
Right, I agree.
That may have been something that he just said in passing, but you know, they made it sound like Bruce was at war with Linus. I don't think that's the case at all.
Yeah, it'd be hard to imagine.
I was just going to say that if the media wants to sort of get something out of this that isn't there, like that Linux has a big old problem, or is there some sort of airing of dirty linen within the Linux community? That those kinds of things just don't stick around, because the truth is that this is a project that there's always issues, and it's hardly life or death. It's just a tool, and there'll be another one to take its place, and it's not going to kill anybody. And Linux is still here.
Hey, listen, they love a good story, and one of the greats. If you go back, the first story was Apple against IBM, and then Apple against Microsoft, and you know, Microsoft against Novell, and now it's Microsoft against Linux, and you know, all they just have to have a continuous war someplace in the economy or in technology or something, and Linux gets lots of interest, so they get a lot of hits and they get a lot of comments.
It is a reflection of the growth of Linux and the relevance of Linux to the general audience, which is increasing, and so take this the whole thing as a positive. It's a reflection of where we're going, where we want to go.
And on the note of IBM, you just mentioned, I recently saw that there's a petition for them to make OS 2 open source. Is this something you can see happening, and how do you think IBM will respond to that?
Let me answer that, Sam. First of all, they can't make it open source because it's DOS. It's 32-bit DOS. And I think they would need the permission of Microsoft. The other part of it that they own is the Presentation Manager. They could open source that. But
do you see at least that happening or no? And does it even matter at
no.
this point?
It would be fun. That's about all I can say. You know, from a technology point of view, it would be fun, but I think people have kind of lost interest in 32-bit DOS. I mean, that was what 95 was made out of in 98. So, I mean, I don't see any love affair with 32-bit DOS.
I think it'd probably be less interesting even than open source layers.
Well, especially
if
to talk about what the experience is like on a 64-bit AMD machine, and then you see the OS and the 3D capabilities. And the next phase, the next gen OS, is just gonna be ridiculous.
Let's hope so.
Yeah, I don't see any.
So moving on to Microsoft, and probably a little bit of a different angle than you usually hear Microsoft in, they recently announced support for running Linux on their virtualization software, Virtual Server 2005. And a snippet from the article, perhaps the significance of this is that Microsoft has acknowledged Linux as an OS people might want to use, which seems an upgrade from its previous status as a communist cancer. And this isn't the first time in the last month or so that Microsoft has kind of officially acknowledged Linux. What are your guys' thoughts on that?
I don't trust anything they do or say, so I don't know what their motives are. They certainly aren't. They certainly don't appear to me to ever be benign. So whatever they're doing, I mean, you know, they've promised things and then not delivered so many times. I don't see.
Do you think they're officially announcing support for Linux in one of their products is kind of an affirmation that Linux in the prime time and in the consumer market, it's here to stay?
No.
Yeah, well.
Well, I don't think that's. Do you think that that's something that they're, that's in the major media? No, it's not in the major media. It's in the kind of media that Linux people look at and enterprises look at. I don't think, I mean, wherever the market is, they're maybe saying something like that.
I'm not sure what magazine that article is in.
They get someone to reconsider.
I think it has to paint Steve Ballmer to announce support for Linux in a product, though. I mean, that's, at first, you know, if you remember back a couple of years ago, Microsoft didn't even really acknowledge that Linux existed. They just, you know, kind of completely ignored it. And then they said, oh, yeah, well, it exists, but it sucks. Don't even pay attention to it. And now they have to kind of do a somewhat of an about-face and say, well, here, we sell this package, and it officially supports Linux out of the box. So, I mean, it's minimally a complete 180 in their attitude.
Yeah, but
I think it affirms
keep in mind, they also sell and support Lotus Notes, and GroupWise and all kinds of things, right? But it's usually an uptake to convert it over to one of their products. So I think all they're doing is they're basically saying, hey, yeah, we have this, we support it, but it's to sell one of their products that might be that probably competes with Linux. So I don't see, you know, their quote-unquote, you know, patting Linux on the head. I think it's just, it's a market reality, and they'll go wherever they see that part of the market.
I see the spirit of the question, which is, yeah, as Tom says, it is part of their competitive strategy for dealing with Linux. But what Jeremy's asking is, does it reflect a kind of inferred acknowledgement of that Linux has arrived? And I think obviously the answer is yes. And then, you know, and then it's a natural part of the process of Linux adoption increasing to, you know, in the data center and on servers. And if Microsoft can do something to make Windows Server more relevant to the people that are using Linux already, they'll try to put Linux on their server and try to interoperate with Linux that does exist with Windows Server. So, yeah, it's a natural thing, and it's, you know, Microsoft are scum and rotten hell. So...
They're also doing it with Solaris, and they never acknowledged Solaris before.
I think they had to acknowledge Solaris out of that lawsuit, though, didn't they? Their hand was kind of forced on that one.
No, there's nothing that says that product... what they're trying to do is they're trying to get in the data center. They want to get in the actual media, I mean, in the actual data center itself. The way IBM is in the data center, the way Solaris is in the data center. They want to get in the data center, and they want their 64-bit product in there. That's what they're trying to do. They're just trying to move in there and take it over like they've done everything else. And so if they can put a filter that will allow them to sucks up the products that are there, they'll do it. But is it a...
And we have to use our powers of resistance.
I just think they're deceptive. And
oh, they're clearly very deceptive. That's putting it lightly.
Yeah. Other.
Okay, yeah, kind of moving on to the next topic. Do you see standardization, and when I say that, kind of like the Linux standards-based LSB-certified distros, is that something that enterprises and governments are looking at in a distro? Because it seems like things like that are making the news less and less. So is it being ignored, or is it just taken for granted that they all are now?
It's being taken for granted. That's one. And then there's also the fact that you've got security-enhanced Linux, which people haven't figured out yet, means that Red Hat Enterprise Linux 4 has the possibility of getting a common criteria certification S2 or BC2I, that level. So it would put it above everybody else as far as security. It would make it the most secure operating system that's ever been created. So I don't know if that's just, you know, something that will take place and reach a critical mass, and then all of a sudden it will be, oh, you know, this is better than trusted Solaris. This is better than everything. So I do think it's important, and I do think they're probably going for certification. And if they get that higher certification, is it B2? I guess it is. All of a sudden, you know, that becomes an operating system that the government has to use.
Anything that's
they're in a secure environment. That's huge.
That is huge.
Yeah, it's gigantic. I mean, and no one else has really paid attention to security-enhanced Linux. I mean, the other small distros, but nobody's really paid that much attention to it. And that's a massively important technology. I love that technology. And, you know, what it does for security is just huge.
Yeah.
Especially for Linux.
Sure.
Especially for the government.
That's all the questions I had originally. One question I had that came up kind of out of some of the stuff we mentioned is, when talking about Sun, you said that they kind of made their own community by converting 1,000 developers to the other side, the firewall. And they seem to have a real problem forming community outside of Sun on an external-facing basis. Do you think this is something that they'll be able to kind of remedy and change, or do you think it's just kind of inherent in their corporate culture?
They don't have a clue as to what it is, what it means, and I don't think that they're going to ever get a clue. Personally, their culture is they're enculturated in such a way. It's the not invented here mentality, you know, and it's they're just so enraptured in their own stuff that they can't get away from it.
And what do you think about them choosing
agree.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Sam.
No, it just is a part of their culture, and if you see Sun as being successful sometime in the future, one of the things they have to do is change that part of their culture, because that's the way software is made now, and they can't go on with this false conception of how an organization in technology interacts with people outside of their company.
And what do you think of them choosing a non-GPL license for OpenSolaris?
Stupid.
Masturbation.
Absolutely, incredibly stupid. And reflective of their thinking that there needs to be another license. They just, again, they don't understand what the community's about. They want to be open. They say they want to be open source, and Jonathan is just going crazy, open source, all in his blog and everything, but they're just not there.
And do you think that, given the non-GPL license, OpenSolaris has a chance to, A, form any kind of community at all, and B, does it have any chance of success at all?
No.
I think it has better chance product than it does having any kind of community around it.
So you think things will basically just stay the same as they've been?
Well, I think they'll be great.
The community...
It's going to be easier to fire people than it is now.
Yeah.
Because they're just open source developers, right?
On the other hand, I mean, Tom has more firsthand experience with Solaris than I do, but I've always felt that there was a place for Solaris somewhere in the data center, and if they could do enough to keep the thing alive and support it for the existing users, then they could get some money out of it, and it could be a part of their suite. But that's just my perception, and I have no hands-on Solaris experience.
McNeely just said that people are now saying that Sun's here to stay because they only lost $9 million this past quarter. Of course, the reason that they only lost $9 million is because they got 60-some-odd million from part of the Microsoft settlement. I mean, they're still losing, you know, almost $100 million a quarter, and they also lost $1 billion. They're gonna run out of money eventually, and they're in denial. These guys, I mean, if I was on the board of directors of Sun, I would start making some real clean sweeps and start over again. But they're not even an attractive purchase for somebody.
And do you think we'll see changes in
their book? They don't make their own stuff anymore.
If you took it out of what they do, they've outsourced everything. The Java's the only important existing thing, and it's impossible to make money from Java.
And do you think we'll see Java open sourced anytime?
They said they were going to at the open source business conference. Oh, Linux World Business Conference or whatever they
call it. The OSBC.
So they were going to open source it, but we'll see.
Do you think they'll follow through on that, though?
That's what I said. We'll see. I don't know.
To some extent.
Okay.
Right,
they thought it was open source in the beginning.
Well, that's all I have. Open source. Did you guys have anything that you wanted to add, or topics you think that are big in the news?
I just want to add to that one.
Okay,
Jeremy, the open sourcing or the going in the direction of more open is really necessary and important. If they could create a scenario where we're actually almost totally open, which means it would have to have a consortium that was very fair and very very aggressively managed for fairness with everyone's involvement. And there were less threats of Java forking. And open source Java is really important because they have to make Java continue to be strong and relevant. They have to embrace the open source and the Linux desktop in particular. There's this myth that, truism, that you run Java on the server and you run .NET on the client because Microsoft and Windows own the client. But if Java wants to forestall the successful adoption of .NET, Java has to do some things to get with the open source community, and open source people consider Java to be a poison, like a bottle with the skull and crossbones on it. On the other hand, Java people use open source tools, and so they're that side of the fence. Java people tend to be open-minded, but open source will tend to reject Java as being a proprietary dependency and as an evil thing. So the Java community has to open its eyes and figure out how it's going to survive and, in fact, thrive if .NET gets any traction.
If Sun had have done Java right in the first place, they wouldn't mind open sourcing it. But they didn't do it right in the first place. They went out and licensed it to people, and IBM sitting there, they would pounce on Java and branch it in a second.
True.
So fork it in a second, pardon me.
So yes, answer is open source. A relatively open Java is extremely important.
Okay.
If they can do it, and that remains to be seen.
Should be interesting to watch, at least.
Should be.
Any other stories that you guys think are important or relevant that you'd like to discuss? Because that's all I had.
Interesting conversation.
No, I think we covered a lot.
I think we did too.
One of the things we might want to talk about is how Skype could get better.
Yeah, for those listening to the show, the beginning part of this, we tried just doing a straight Skype call and had absolutely, positively no luck at all. And all of us have broadband and fairly good connections, and it just didn't happen. So I ended up calling via Skype out Sam and Tom, both on their landline. And the quality of this call, actually, I think has been pretty good. But moving forward for LQ Radio, we might have to go the Skype out route. I think that was terrible.
Who knows what the problems were?
Yeah,
but I've had no problems. Yeah, Skype's been really good for me in the past. I don't know what this problem was.
I've had minor problems with it in the past, but nothing to the degree that we had earlier today. But it is something that appears needs to be improved.
I've had calls all over the world, so it's kind of strange. I mean, halfway across the planet, and never had any problems like this.
Well, I'm optimistic.
It may just been the wrong time of day or something.
Could be. They might even be having problems on their end. I mean, I guess it's hard to tell. I want to thank you both for being on the show and being my first interview. I think it went great, and I really do appreciate it.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, thank you.
It was
a great honor, and I really appreciate it. By the way, Sam's going to be speaking in where in Italy, Sam?
Oh, at the Java Italia in Milan. Come June 22nd.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'm going to be speaking in Amman, Jordan. I'm going to be speaking in Amman, Jordan on July 26th.
And what's that for?
27th. It's an open source conference for the Middle East.
Oh, interesting.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, thanks again, guys.